Our next speaker is Alan Dicken. Alan is professor of geology at McMaster University. Alan.
Thank you. To find the little thing. Okay. And let me just make sure. Yeah, okay. So, I think what you just heard, I could say, as a geologist, is the truly desperate lengths that creationists have gone to try to make their model fit with what they think is geology. And the question is, what drove them to such desperate lengths? Well, part of the story is historical misunderstandings, perhaps, of what the flood is about. So one of the most important sources of evidence about when historians think the flood occurred is the Sumerian King List, which is one of the versions is shown here in Oxford. And the Sumerian King List gives a date for a minor flood. I'm reading here. The date given by the King List corresponds to a minor flood in Mesopotamia, but this minor flood barely interrupted daily life in Mesopotamia, and it certainly didn't annihilate all of the known world, which is what the text says. So, for example, Paul Seeley on Biologos is commenting, the flood, not global, barely local, mostly theological. Well, this is an argument which, maybe for adults this argument is okay, but as I'm asking, well, what would you say if you're teaching this flood in Sunday school? This is where these problems become more acute. How can we reconcile the story with the science? And here's a quote from John Golingay, although I realized when I reread Hebrews, in fact, it was said rather better in Hebrews 1, that's 11:1. Anyway, quoting from Hebrews 11:7, by faith Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear built an ark to save his family. And the key thing, of course, in Hebrews chapter 11 is by faith, and the key thing is, well, if Noah didn't need to build an ark to save his family, then he didn't have any faith. And the basis of our faith is based on the faith, one of the bases of our faith is the faith displayed by the ancients. Okay, so I can't see the thing from here. So this on the right-hand side is a summary of the beginning of the Sumerian King List. And this is from the example that I showed in the picture earlier, the Well-Blundell Prism in Oxford. And this places the flood here. So this will be the antediluvian cities, and then the flood, and then the dynasty of Kish and Uruk. And based on archaeological evidence, which I'll describe in a minute, this dynasty begins at 2900 BC, and therefore, based on this version of the King List, the flood occurred at 2900 BC. Problem is, as I previously alluded to, there is a flood that occurred at this time, but very minor. Yeah, it caused minor damage to some houses, like, or something. This was a very mature stage of civilization. There were already trade links all around the world. It's completely non-credible that this minor flood annihilated like world civilization. Well, the way we approach the King List has totally changed, really, based on a new version published in 2003. The newly published version predates that the version I showed you earlier, by 250 years. So this is a bad photo of the newly published version, and the key point being it doesn't mention the flood at all. So this is the beginning of the version when kingship descended from heaven. The kingship was in Kish. We already talked about the Kish dynasty. Okay, so what is it about the dynasty of Kish which was so significant for the beginning of the composition of the king list? Well, there is actually some excellent archaeological evidence which supports the idea that the king list actually presented quite a realistic account of Sumerian history from then on. One of the things is top right here, a new form of architecture which is characteristic of a royal palace. It has a double wall enclosure, it has a labyrinth which was meant to disorientate visiting emissaries, and then it has an audience chamber where, like, the king could sit, you know, in royal splendor. That form of architecture first begins with the Kish dynasty. And here is the earliest contemporary royal inscription. In other words, this inscription is from 2500 BC. It's been dated, or at least the version on the right, it's been dated from an actual excavation, showing that it's recording events a few hundred years earlier, but within, you know, within the realistic memory of continued, you know, from one person to another. This says, May Berigasi, king of Kish. So this is May Berigasi, king of Kish. And the important thing here is king is a man with a crown on his head, essentially. And this is the Sumerian sign for Kish. It's actually meant to be the head of a donkey because Kish sounds like the Sumerian for donkey. The thing you can mainly recognize it by is by these two very long strokes here, because I'm going to show you in a moment. But first of all, I need to briefly explain how Sumerian writing changed over time. So this is a little summary of some Sumerian signs, showing the earliest on the left and moving across for each one. And I want to just discuss two or three of them. So here is a picture of a cow's head. And as we go across through time, this is BC, you can see that it becomes more and more symbolic. But then at this point here, it gets turned on its side. So now it's become totally unrecognizable. The star, obviously, when it's turned on its side, it doesn't change much. This is the sign for land or place or something like that. It could be a picture of the two rivers with fields in between. It's not quite clear. And then it evolves in a similar way. And then head, this is very obvious. You can see it's a human head, and then it gradually becomes more abstract. And then, of course, once it's turned on its side, it's unintelligible. Well, briefly, I just want to show you how this happened from some actual evidence. So from the end of this period, the cylinder of Cyrus, you can perfectly see the writing goes from left to right like we would read. Here is the Stele of Hammurabi in the Louvre Museum. Those of you at the front at least can see that the writing is in vertical columns. So this is before the thing was turned on its side. So this is the Sumerian king list, or the well-blundled prism, as it should be displayed in Oxford. And we can see perfectly well it should be read like this because it's got a hole through the middle to put it on a stick, wooden dowel. So you can see the similarity of the idea that you read it like this, except that the writing's going the other way. All right, so now let us look at the close-up of the Sumerian king list. So this is a close-up of part of the well-blundled prism, as I just showed on the previous slide. And this is copied version to make it easier to see. This is a Romanized transliteration. This is the translation of these particular lines. And we'll just read the English, I guess. The office of king was lowered from heaven Kish Place, the office of the king, was. And pointer. All right, well, I assumed I'd be able to point somehow. Yeah, okay, so somewhere that is the picture of the man with the crown on his head, and that says Nam Lugal. And to the left there, above my hand, is the two long strokes that say that's Kish. And so this is in the middle of that, the well-blundled prism. But if we go over here, you can see quite clearly here is the man, the man with the crown on his head, and there is a sign for Kish. And if you look closely above here, you can see also the sign for Lugal. So this is the beginning, and it says Nam Lugal. The Nam is missing because it's been worn off the corner. And the office of king and Kish Ki, that means the Kish place, Lugal. So there in the next row here. All right, so what this shows you is the original version of the Kinglish did not mention the flood at all. It just started with the kingdom of Kish. So all this evidence is completely irrelevant to the date of the flood. Well, we can make a quick argument here, a logical argument, about when the flood should have been. If the flood was truly a cataclysm that lasted quite a long time, well, a year is what it says in Genesis, if there'd been any mud brick buildings, yeah, they hadn't learned to fire, they hadn't started firing their mud bricks, they'd have been severely damaged at least, even if they weren't washed away. So logically, the flood happened before all of these mud brick remains that basically go back to 5000 BC. And here's another completely separate line of evidence that says, yeah, the flood should have been much earlier than 2900 BC, because Genesis thinks that all Middle Eastern peoples were descended from Noah's sons. We'll come back to that if I have time, hopefully. All right, now I'm going to go through this bit, frankly, very quick, because I've talked about it before, and in actual fact, I do have a paper that's going to come out in PSCF, which will describe this in a lot more detail. So excuse me for kind of running through it very quickly. We can identify the period in the last 10,000 years when there were very intense rainfall events, very, very intense periods of precipitation based on climatic records. And one of the ways we can do this is from Lake Van, which is around the headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates. This is where a flood would begin, a flood in Mesopotamia. And Lake Van is a terminal lake. It means it has no outflow. So the level of the lake reflects precipitation. So this, based on the shape of the lake and the levels of the lake, which have been recorded in drill cores and dated with radiocarbon, we can model the relative influx. And what it shows is when the peaks here are wet periods. So wet period, very wet period. And specifically, we know this begins because the flood, the rising water in the lake starts a certain core at dated to 6000 BC. So this is a key dated point. After 6000 BC, we have the peak here. So that means maximum rainfall intensity. And we can correlate that. That was a kind of broad brush dating after 6000. We can correlate that with some other paleoclimate evidence from a cave in near Jerusalem. The key point is, although it's a fair way away, it's part of the regional climate system of the Fertile Crescent. To summarize very quickly, higher delta carbon 13 signatures are produced by influx of rainfall into this cave, and because of lack of equilibration with soil organic matter, which will be lower. Okay, so the peaks here represent high rainfall events leading to flooding events in the cave. It's between like 6 and 5,000 BC, and here's more recent time. I've cut it off at 2,000 BC. You see, this period of flooding was never repeated in the cave. So evidence that, this truly was a very wet period. Oh yeah, and I should also say, in the Mediterranean, intense Nile flooding gives it's a massive influx of fresh water, which sets up a stratification of the Mediterranean and preserves organic matter, which form a specific layer called the sapropel. And that's another way of dating this very wet event, which is very well known to geologists. Now, at the same time as this very wet event is occurring, sea level is still rising from the last ice age. And this is a plot of sea level change relative to present day, thousands of years before present this would be. At this point here, sea level is rising at about 1 centimeter a year. And it has been here for 10,000 years. It's gone up 100 meters. And this is 6,000 BC. It's just at the point when it's about to level off, right? So very suddenly, by 5,000 BC, the rate of sea level rise is dropping. The key thing... The key thing on the next slide is that during the last glacial period, because sea level was much lower, the rivers cut little gorges into the plain of Mesopotamia. This is a cross section. This is actually from southeast Iran, but it's near the mouth of, it's near the top of the Persian Gulf. So it's the bottom end of Mesopotamia. And what this shows is like these are the sediments, pre-glacial sediments, and this represents one side of a gorge. So this is a 10-meter deep gorge, or thereabouts. It's a small gorge, but the important thing is when the river's confined to this gorge, it can't flood because it's confined to the gorge. So what happens is sea level is filling up. And so we can see critically, that here's the radiocarbon dates. 6,000 BC, 5,800, and finally by 5,700 BC, seawater has reached the top of the gorge, essentially. So what it now means is, if there's a flood, the water can't get away. So in other words, 5,700 BC represents the time when, for the first time, a catastrophic river flood is going to cause complete flooding of the Mesopotamian plain. Now, I don't have time to show you all of the geography and so on like that, but a major issue, this is in the Neolithic, by the way. 5700 BC is in the Neolithic. So, question is, how could Noah build an ark in the Neolithic without metal tools? And the answer is, well, you've misunderstood what the ark was like. It's a long story, which I don't have time to go into, but this is what you should think the ark was really like. It was like a big raft that had the size of a 1 acre field, and this size is common to the biblical story and three Mesopotamian accounts, and it had a house on it. The ark would have looked just like this. Now, without having time to go into that, I'm not going into that because I specifically want to address another issue that's associated with the flood story. And this is the concept in Genesis 10 that all the Middle Eastern peoples were derived from Noah's sons. And the question is, how does that work, basically? So, Genesis, these are the clans of Noah's sons according to their lines of descent within their nations. From these, the nations spread out over the whole earth after the flood. To what extent is this statement scientifically valid? What we want to do with the text, how we want to approach the text here is we want to avoid falling into two opposite problems. We don't want to be naive and think that this text is a scientific account, an anthropological account of Middle Eastern peoples, but we also don't want to say that this account is fictitious. So I want to try and see if there's a basis for this belief without slavishly thinking it's a literal statement. So for example, these are the descendants of Ham and Shem, and we can see that Canaan is included in the descendants of Ham. This is obviously very well known. Whereas, in fact, the Canaanites, this is the linguistic analysis or whatever, simplified linguistic analysis. The Canaanites, linguistically, are very closely related to the Hebrews, and they're all they're Western Semitic. So therefore, Canaan has been put in the wrong place, if you like, as a descendant of Ham. But the Canaanites have been put there for political reasons. In other words, Ham represents all the enemies of Israel, and so the Canaanites are in with them. On the other hand, the Assyrians have been grouped with the descendants of Shem, which seems ironic because the Assyrians were the enemies of Israel. But that was later. So this is evidence that this political account dates from before the divided monarchy. So it's evidence this is an early account. So it's not a scientific account, but it's a realistic political account of relatedness. Now, how does that fit with, well, whatever we call it, scientific and cultural and so on evidence? Well, some very interesting convergences. So I haven't talked about Japheth. So the sons of Japheth include the Greeks, which is Javan, and the Medes, which is Madai, who are related to the Persians. So the sons of Japheth are the Indo-Europeans, as opposed to the other Semitic peoples. And so the Indo-Europeans are actually very well portrayed, as it were, by their association with Japheth. And this is from 2015, a reconstruction of the Indo-European language tree, complete with estimates of ages of divisions. And what you can see then is Proto-Indo-European is diverged from Anatolian, which is Hittite, well, actually, kind of just after the flood. That must be a coincidence, we'll say. Okay, and then basically what happens is these guys stay put, the Anatolians, and everyone else leaves. So this is the Anatolian exodus. It gives rise to the Greeks and Armenians over here, and it gives rise to the Eurasian steppe over here. This gives rise to everyone in Northern and Western Europe and so on. So actually a kind of remarkable coincidence here of concepts. But in fact, we have some other completely independent evidence for this kind of phenomenon. This is all basically about the fact that the idea in Genesis, that Genesis has the idea that like everyone's spread out from these guys after the flood. Did this really happen? Okay, so what I'm doing here is, now I'm going to look at the genomic evidence. I couldn't resist it because it seemed relevant to some of the themes of the conference. Well, the first thing we need to do is to back up to the agricultural revolution, which is 8,500 BC, and it occurred in northern Mesopotamia here, and here's the two rivers, that's Mesopotamia, right, between the two rivers, and then we have some of the main important sites, Karasadeg at the top, Göbekli Tepe, Abu Huraira. This is the Fertile Crescent, right? So that's to locate you. Now, here's some neat evidence. This is genomic evidence for the location where the agricultural revolution occurred in southeast Anatolia. Okay, so the earliest domesticated version of wheat is einkorn, and this shows a tree of relatedness of einkorn, and this is domesticated einkorn over here in red, and these are all wild einkorn varieties, and this is the wild einkorn from Karasadeg. This is a feral, which means it's a mixture of the domesticated and the wild, and what you see is the domesticated is most closely related to this wild einkorn. So this shows that all domesticated einkorns originated from southeast Anatolia, which is where we know the agricultural revolution occurred here. This is, if you like, the proof. All right, so now, I've got a couple of minutes left, I guess. Now, the human genomic evidence. Now, this diagram, like, condenses an insane amount of genomic evidence. This is genomic-wide. This is a principal component analysis of genomic-wide single nucleotide polymorphisms. And it's these are the eigenvectors, the principal eigenvectors. So we don't really need to know about all the details here. The important thing is, here is the Anatolia pre-pottery Neolithic field. It's actually very small. And at the extremes of this eigenvector map, are pre-Neolithic peoples. And what it basically shows is mixing between the Anatolian genomic signature and people to the north, south, east, and west. So very briefly, north is the Caucasus, east is Iran, south is the Levant, and west is Europe. So what I hope you can see is that there is genuine mixing in all four directions. And the timing of, so we're going to just momentarily at the movement to the west, and here is completely independent evidence for the timing of this movement. This is what Genesis says. The sons of Javan, from these, the maritime people spread out into their territories. This is radiocarbon dating, and this is just a summary of frequency against age. What it shows is, for the Aegean, there's a huge peak at 6000 BC, and what it's showing is a wave of people moving from Anatolia to the west, 6000 BC. Now, that's actually slightly before the flood, but it doesn't matter. The point is, the biblical author still has a correct picture that people were just moving in every direction, and, well, they assumed it was because of the flood. In fact, these people were already moving away before the flood, but it doesn't matter because they just have this impression, a massive outward movement of people. Yeah, so we have evidence of the flood of 5700 BC. It can explain how it's reasonable to believe that everyone could possibly be descended from the survivors of the flood. It tallies with the fact there was a massive exodus from the Middle East, and it suggests, yeah, that Genesis does describe real history, but from the limited perspective of the ancient author. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Let's take time for just two questions, and then if you have more, you can ask Alan afterwards.
Yeah, sure.
Any questions? Yes.
Some of those early numbers had like 20,000 years, several of them in there.
Did I understand you said that those were not then supported, or those still have some validity?
Sorry, you lost me.
In a very early slide.
The king list.
King list.
Yeah. Oh, well, 2900 BC was the beginning of the kingdom of Kish, and so the king, the original version of the king list said kingship was ascended from heaven and the kingship was in Kish, and then it went on from there. Later on in the old Babylonian period, well, basically, they wanted to enhance the gravitas of the king list. So they're like, hey, why don't we put in an earlier stage to make it seem more impressive? So they basically
added years to it.
They added a fictitious segment of the antediluvian kings and the flood.
Okay.
And in fact, there is a historical reason for this. In fact, there was another competing king list from a different city, which claimed alternately that they were the kind of originators, and this was a sort of comeback. Yeah. So it's all politics.
Last question.
Alan, this is real good work. By the way, you could have picked from 10 other very recent Referee Journal papers in Science and Nature that would show that kind of a genetic diversity.
Good work. Yes. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks again,
Alan.
Thanks to all our speakers, and also talk to Ken and Steve about these books.